This is Grow in Grace, a daily teaching ministry of Palmetto Baptist Church in Greenville, South Carolina. We like to throw extravagant parties to celebrate great accomplishments. In the book of Daniel, we find a pagan king celebrating his kingdom with a grand party. In order to demonstrate the power and greatness of his kingdom, he uses vessels from the temple in Jerusalem in his celebration. God sends a message to this arrogant king with a finger writing on the wall. Today, Pastor Sam will begin a sermon titled, When God Crashes Your Party, from Daniel chapter 5. Let's listen together so we can grow in grace.
You know, it might surprise you, as it did me, that many of the sayings that sort of pepper our language from time to time have their origin in the Bible. Let me give you a couple of examples. I have 10 of them here. Let me give you just a few for time's sake. But how many of you have heard the statement, the blind leading the blind? How many of you have heard that statement? That comes right out of Matthew 15, verse 14, when Jesus rebuked the Pharisees. And then he said to his disciples, leave them alone. They are blind leaders of the blind. And if the blind lead the blind, both shall be in the ditch. So that next time you hear somebody say that, you can mentally say, well, I know where that came from. How about casting your pearls before swine? How many of you have heard that one? Yeah? That comes right out of Matthew chapter 7, verse 6, another teaching of Jesus. How about this one? There's a fly in the ointment. How many of you have heard that say? There's something that's not quite right here. There's something that is going to mess this thing up. There's a fly in the ointment. That comes right out of Ecclesiastes 10, verse 1. How about this one? You're at your wit's end. How many of you have heard that? Did you know that comes out of the Bible? That comes out of Psalm 107, verses 23 through 27, when the psalmist describes sailors on a boat that are being tossed to and fro, and they're out of options to lighten the boat. And here's what he says. They reel to and fro. They stagger like a drunken man and are at their wit's end. Have you heard this one? By the skin of my teeth. How many of you have heard that one? All right? How many of you have used that one? Yeah? Did you know that came from the Bible? That came right out of the book of Job. Let me read it to you. Job 19:20. Job says, my bone clings to my skin and my flesh, and I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth. So all of these sayings that sort of pepper our language, many of them have origins in the Bible. And there are two that come out of the book of Daniel. How many of you have heard the statement, feet of clay, to describe somebody? It speaks of someone who has great honor, great power, great glory, great majesty, but has a fatal or a foundational weakness. And sooner or later, that fatal or foundational weakness, that feet of clay part of him or her, is going to cause the entire enterprise or the entire person to come down. And then, of course, there is the very famous saying that we say very often when we see something and we realize the end has already been decreed. This is unavoidable. It can't be stopped. The handwriting is on the wall. How many of you have heard that statement? It comes right out of the text that we are looking at this morning. This is precisely, by the way, the point of the chapter. This is what the text is revealing, that the unfortunate, unfortuitous, and unavoidable end has come for two things. One of those things is a kingdom that had lasted for more than 60 years. It is the kingdom of gold, the one that Daniel interpreted for Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold that he saw in the statue in chapter 2. As we come into the events of chapter 5, we are looking at the events. The entire chapter focuses attention on the events of one day. In fact, the events of one night. And by the end of this evening, the entire Babylonian Empire that we've been reading about for four chapters will have come to an end. But that's not the only thing that comes to an end. the life of a man, King Belshazzar, also comes to an end for very similar reasons. And so as you come into this text, the only bridge that you have between the events of chapter 4, which happened 25 years earlier. I mean, by the time you get done reading chapter 4 and you turn your eye to chapter 5, verse 1, 25 years have passed. King Nebuchadnezzar has been dead for 23 of those years. So there were 2 years or so after the vision when he enjoyed a restoration to his kingdom. And then 23 years later, he's been dead for those years. 2 years later, he dies, and 23 years later, we open up the account in Daniel chapter 5. There have been four kings that have come and gone between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. So a good bit has happened in the empire. The empire has been in great decline. The Persians, who we're going to read about at the end of the chapter, have been on the ascendancy. Cyrus has been marching through the empire and has been systematically handing defeat after defeat after defeat to the Babylonian Empire. And the only thing that kept the Babylonian Empire in play was the fact that they were the food source. They were the supply chain for all of Cyrus's armies. And that's why particularly the city of Babylon and the regions around it had not yet been taken. But as you open up chapter 5, we're on the very last day of the empire. The armies of Cyrus are outside the walls of the city, and we enter into this lavish banquet that we see here in the text. And the only bridge that we have for all of this is what Nebuchadnezzar left us with in the final thing he said at the end of chapter 4. I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol the honor of the King of Heaven. We're going to read about a king who does exactly the opposite. One of his descendants, his grandson. For all of his works are right and his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. That's the bridge that Daniel wants us to walk over from the kingdom that Nebuchadnezzar ruled to the kingdom that Belshazzar ruined. And maybe the best way to do it this morning is to look at this narrative from four perspectives, or four camera angles, if you will. And so the first perspective that we're given is in the first 9 verses, where we get the perspective of a wicked ruler who is defying God. He is doing exactly the opposite of everything that Nebuchadnezzar did at the end of his life. Nebuchadnezzar had been deeply humbled by the Lord. And as we looked at chapter 4, we concluded not only had he been humbled by the Lord, he had been converted, soundly converted to the Lord. And he had praised the Lord, he had extolled the Lord, he had honored the living God, the King of Heaven. And we come into a scene where the last king of Babylon, Belshazzar, his grandson, is doing exactly the opposite. Now, it's interesting to notice in verse 1 that there is a great deal made about this banquet. And the first thing that the writer wants you to know is who's hosting it. And the first thing he wants you to know about this king is his name, Belshazzar. It's going to show up several times strategically in the passage. And so it behooves us for just a moment to remind ourselves how similar this name is to the Babylonian name that Daniel received from Nebuchadnezzar. There's going to be a major contrast between these two Belshazzars. One is going to speak for God, and the other is going to look to the wrong gods for help. The name Belshazzar literally honors one of the chief gods of Babylon, the god Bel. And the word Belshazzar actually means, may the god Bel protect the king. Here is a king whose god was Bel, and he's going to look very clearly to this god for help. And someone who bears his same name, who speaks to a very different god, is going to stand before him and show him the folly of looking at that god for help. Now, Belshazzar, as I said, is not immediately the follower of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had two sons who were kings before Belshazzar, who were slain and deposed, and then there was an interloper who came, and he was immediately removed, and then there was a big noble, a very well-known noble in Babylon, who became the king in his place, and his name was Nabonidus. In fact, he is the king of Babylon at the time that we're reading about. He ended up marrying one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters. So Nabonidus is married to Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. This daughter had been deeply involved in the final years of her father's kingdom. She had been involved in some of the projects that he had done. So she was very well acquainted with Nebuchadnezzar. She was very well acquainted with what had happened in the kingdom. And she is going to make an appearance in this chapter. She not only is Nebuchadnezzar's daughter and Nabonidus' wife, she is Belshazzar's mother, which makes Belshazzar the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, even though there are all these kings in between. And the reason that is important is because of a prophecy that Jeremiah made in Jeremiah chapter 27, verses 6 and 7, when he predicts the fall of Babylon when Nebuchadnezzar's grandson is in power. And so here you have the literal grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, and he is hosting a banquet. Now let me ask you this question. Why would anybody host a banquet when the Persian army and all of its power is sitting outside the walls of your city? What would possess somebody to do this? Why would you host a lavish banquet like this for 1,000 of your lords to drink wine in the banquet hall when you have this kind of an enemy sitting outside of your gates? Well, maybe it was a show of bravado. Maybe he was trying to say to the lords, look, there's no possible way that Persian army is going to tear down the massive walls that my grandfather made. More likely, the feast fell on a day that was sacred to the gods. And so rather than forgo the feast and chance offending the gods that he desperately needed, Nebuchadnezzar probably hosted this feast in honor of the gods. And certainly you see that, or indications of that, in these 9 verses, which makes this a religious ceremony. There is worship that is going on here in the text. And you can see the arrogant defiance of this king, not just in his sensuality, in the sense that he has his wives and his concubines there and 1,000 of his lords, and they're drinking wine, they're tasting wine. The word taste there isn't just talking about a little sip. It means that they have deeply imbibed. In other words, this is Daniel's way of letting you know that this was a drunken feast with religious overtones that was very sensual in its nature, because it wasn't just the men who were doing the drinking. You'll see later on in the text that the women were doing the drinking as well. And so it was very sensual. And then it was blasphemous. It was very sacrilegious in its nature. Right in the middle of all of this, if you notice in the text, verse 2, when Belshazzar was in the midst of all of this revelry, in the midst of all of this sensuality, he calls for the sacred vessels of the temple of God that had been brought to Babylon by his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar. We met these vessels all the way back in chapter 1. And we were reminded about something. We were reminded that Nebuchadnezzar didn't take these vessels on his own. If you go back to chapter 1, you'll remember that God gave into his hand these vessels. And he brought them, and he kept them in the temple of his God. His grandson Belshazzar, on the last night of his life, facing this immense threat, honoring the gods of wood and of stone and of brass or bronze and of gold, calls for these very vessels to be brought into the banquet hall, filled with wine, and used to give honor and praise to the gods who had no life. How is God going to respond to this kind of an affront to his glory? How is he going to respond to this kind of affront to his holiness? I mean, these were his vessels. They had been in his house. And it's as though Belshazzar goes in and by his own hand, he makes a feast. His grandfather made an idol in chapter 3. He makes a feast. Both of them in honor of gods that have no life and gods that cannot redeem or gods cannot deliver. And here he brings the vessels in and he uses them in great sacrilegious and blasphemous ways. How is God going to respond? And by the way, how is God going to respond when we do the same thing? When we treat his holiness lightly. We sang about the holiness of God. We sang about the ownership of God over all the world. We sang this morning, or we listened and entered in. This is his world. It's not my world. The little world that I have, that I live in, where I have my own little life, that's not mine either. It all belongs to the Lord. And what does God say, and how does God respond when I use what belongs to him for things that dishonor him? And sometimes for things that even blaspheme him and are sacrilegious before him. And this is exactly what happens. And so you see the divine invasion, the hand of God appears. The hand in whose life Belshazzar's life is in. God's hand is the one that has his life. It's the one in whose hand is his breath. This hand appears over against the wall. It's just a hand. And it writes a message on the wall. The God from whom these sacred vessels belonged is very much in charge of them still. And when when Belshazzar did this, the finger of this great God wrote out a sentence against him. This is not the first time in our Bibles where we encounter the finger of God. In Exodus chapter 8, for example, Pharaoh's magicians speak to Pharaoh, and they say, look, all of Egypt is destroyed. The finger of God has done this, and it's because of you. You are the one who has brought the finger of God against us. And so the finger of God is a metaphor for the power of God, the activity of God, the engagement of God. The finger of God in Exodus chapter 31, Moses reminds us, gave to us or carved out the Ten Commandments. In Luke chapter 11, Jesus talks about casting out demons by the finger of God. And when that happens, you will know that the kingdom of heaven is in your midst. And here the finger of God appears and it writes a death sentence on the wall. And as soon as Belshazzar saw this, he was humiliated. I mean, he became desperate. Notice his fear. His color changed in verse 6. His thoughts alarmed him. This is exactly how Nebuchadnezzar responded in chapter 2 and again in chapter 4 when the dreams came. But Belshazzar's fear is even greater. His limbs gave away and his knees knocked together. The idea of knees knocking together there is the Hebrew for that is literally the joints of his loins, the knots of his loins released. And he became incontinent. He lost control of his bowels in front of 1,000 of his lords. And in utter desperation, verse 7, he cried loudly. The Hebrew expression there is he screamed. He cried out, he screamed to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. Now we met these guys back in chapter 2, didn't we? And we met them again in chapter 3, and we met them again in chapter 4, and every time they're called, they come trotting in, and they are absolutely what? They're useless. They have no access to the wisdom that God has made available. Somebody else is going to be required. And how many times do we trot out the same old places where we go for help, or we go for advice, or we go for wisdom? Because maybe this time it'll be different. Maybe this time it'll be better. When we really need someone who has access to wisdom from above. someone who understands the mind of God because he or she is familiar with the Word of God. Many of us from time to time are in situations, we find ourselves in places, sometimes of our own making, sometimes not, where our lives have come apart. The knots of our life have untied, and it's as though we have just come apart. And we are desperate for answers. We are desperate for help. This is where Belshazzar was. All of his arrogance, all of his idolatry, all of his immorality, his sensuality, all of the blasphemy, all of the sacrilege have all become silent in a moment. And he is terrified. His life has come apart. And he needs answers. He needs help. Maybe not in that way or for those reasons, but from time to time, you're going to find yourself in a place where you need help. And Belshazzar went to the same people that he always went to who never were able to help him to start with. And oftentimes, that's what we do. We just go back again and again and again to the same broken wells because maybe there will be a little bit of water this time that we can bring up and we can bring to help us get our life back together. And what you need is someone who knows the Word of God and can share with you from that Word the mind of God. That's one of the reasons that soul care in a church like this is so important to us. Those who do soul care in this church are not perfect people, but they are people who have spent time understanding the Word of God so that they can discern the mind of God and bring it to bear in your life and in mine when we most need it. And so that's what's going on here. You have a wicked king who has defied God, and God has intervened and crashed the party, and all of a sudden everything that this king was standing on dissipated. And he is a mess. That's perspective number one. Perspective number two is the perspective of a wise woman who is sent from God. And you meet her in verses 10 through 12. God interjects a small mercy into this scenario by bringing all of this to the attention of a woman who wasn't at the banquet. She's not one of the wives. She's not one of the concubines. She hasn't been at the banquet, but she has heard the tumult that has gone on. She has received a report of what's been happening to Belshazzar, and so she comes in. And the reason that God brings her in, because she's probably the one person that Belshazzar might listen to in a moment like this, and that's because she's his mother. This is the queen mother. And we shared a little bit of that before at the opening of our time together. Most likely the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar married Nabonidus when he came to the throne to give him legitimacy, fathered and became the mother, rather, of Belshazzar. She had been an eyewitness of Nebuchadnezzar's true glory, the golden age of the empire. She had lived through the demise of that empire. She was witnessing Belshazzar, her son's, sham glory.
Thank you, Pastor Sam. We'll continue this sermon next time on Grow in Grace. Today's speaker is Dr. Sam Horn. He's the pastor for preaching and vision at Palmetto Baptist Church. PBC meets at 2730 Anderson Road, Greenville, South Carolina. If you live locally, come join one of our morning worship services at 9 or 10:45 a.m. every Sunday. You can find us online at pbcpowdersville.org. If you have any questions about today's message or about Palmetto Baptist Church, reach out to radio@pbcpowdersville.org. Grow in Grace is recorded by the audio team at PBC and produced by CJ Billieu. Join us again next time, so together we can grow in grace.